Greetings and welcome to the IOMSN Town Hall Discussions Conference Call, Pediatric MS Nursing. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A brief question-and-answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star zero on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to introduce your host, Ms. Lori Mayer. Thank you, Ms. Mayer. You may begin.
Thank you, Manny. Good evening, everyone. My name is Lori Mayer, and I'm Director of Medical Research Services for an MS clinic in Austin, Texas. Welcome. And on behalf of the IOMSN and as co-chair for this program, tonight's discussion will be entitled Pediatric MS Nursing, and Jennifer Boyd will be our guest speaker. These educational sessions are held by telephone, and currently we're holding them on the second Wednesday of each month. And I think for the fall quarter, we're going to be changing that to the second Monday of each month. So we'll keep you posted on that, and we'll also keep you posted on what the topics will be to come. This discussion is led by an IOMSN member who's speaking on a selected topic for about 15 minutes, which then we will open up for discussion and limited to 1 hour. We do want to acknowledge and to show our appreciation to Novartis for supporting this project through an unrestricted grant. So for this evening, we begin the town hall discussions, and I'd like to introduce to you Jennifer Boyd. She has been a clinical nurse specialist in neurology at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, Canada, for the past 16 years, and had been involved in its pediatric MS clinic since its inception in 1999. She does have her certification in neuroscience nursing from Canada and is a multiple sclerosis certified nurse. She also has an adjunct clinical appointment with the Faculty of Nursing at the University of Toronto and an appointment as a project investigator with the Sick Kids Research Institute. She's active in numerous professional organizations, and Jennifer has been the past president of the Association of Child Neurology Nurses and a former member of the IOMSN Board of Directors from 2006 to 2012. Jennifer is currently an advisor on the editorial board of the MS Exchange, and this evening she's going to be discussing pediatric MS nursing. So, Jennifer, I'm going to hand the program over to you.
Thank you very much, Lori. I'm pleased to be speaking to everyone tonight, and I hope there'll be some good discussion. So I'll talk briefly. It's a big topic, but I'll just start off with the common question that people ask me. How common is MS in children? And about 5% of patients with MS are diagnosed before 18 years of age. So if you consider how many hundreds of thousands of people in the United States have MS, and 5% of those would have been diagnosed before the age of 18. Now, greater than 95% of children present with a relapsing remitting course. So secondary progressive MS is actually quite rare in children. And also, children do not tend to progress as quickly as adults. So there's been a study by Boyko in 2002 that found that 50% with onset of MS before 16 years of age switched to secondary progressive MS after 23 years, when you compare that to the natural history studies in adults, which indicate that would be 10 years. But when you stop to think about some children might be diagnosed when they're 7, 23 years later means they're 30. So although the progression may be slower, they still may develop secondary progressive MS at a younger age. So how does one diagnose pediatric MS? Well, actually, the presenting symptoms are actually quite similar to adults. They get the optic neuritis, they get hemisensory symptoms, hemimotor symptoms, ataxias, variety of things. But one of the difficulties when diagnosing children is they may have difficulty describing some of their symptoms, particularly sensory symptoms or visual symptoms. I'll give you an example of one of our patients who had an initial hemimotor, hemisensory attack, and we happened to be just following him up, and he had a clinic appointment about a year later. And the nurse in our clinic checked his visual acuity, and they found it was 20 over 200 in his right eye. He had not mentioned anything to his parents that he had difficulty seeing out of the one eye, and so we actually did diagnose him with MS at that time. And if we hadn't happened to be seeing him in clinic, we wouldn't have diagnosed him. And we've also had situations where kids get hit in the head by, say, a baseball because they haven't seen the ball coming because they have optic neuritis, and that's when it gets diagnosed. The other thing with children, especially when they're under 11 years of age, they tend to have larger, more ill-defined lesions on MRI, and they're also more likely to present with an encephalopathy and multifocal neurological deficits, and they make me much more ill with the onset of their disease. Interestingly, with McDonald criteria, just in the 2010 revisions, they did add pediatric MS information, really indicating that children do present similarly to adults, but recognizing some of the MRI changes may be a little different in younger children and the fact that they may present more with these encephalopathic processes. Now, of course, all MS diagnoses can relate to a diagnosis of exclusion. And with children, you certainly have to rule out things like mitochondrial disorders and metabolic diseases, especially when it seems to be more of a primary progressive kind of presentation, because, as I said, it is quite rare in children. Also, acute disseminated encephalomyelitis is quite common in children, much more common than in adults. You have to rule out infections, obviously, lymphomas, inflammatory diseases such as lupus, vasculopathies, and even vitamin deficiencies. A lot of people ask me, is MS increasing? Many people said they hardly ever saw children in their practice, and it seems to be more and more we're seeing them. It's not clear why that may be. A part of it just may be enhanced awareness, and there's better monitoring. We certainly watch our patients who present with a demyelinating disease much more closely. Obviously, improved diagnostic capabilities, and even just the greater impetus to diagnose earlier in the disease process. Now there's treatment options. 20 years ago, we wouldn't have thought of having that option of treating children, and so many physicians didn't even think to try to diagnose a child fairly early. They would sort of wait and see how things went. There's also potential environmental influences. There was one recent study by a French group that found children exposed to secondhand smoke were more likely to develop MS. And there's always that query, are there different kinds of viruses that make them more susceptible? And even overall lifestyle changes. We're hearing a lot about vitamin D and the importance of vitamin D in the autoimmune process. And what we're finding is obviously the newer generation are not outside as much. They may be indoors more, and they're using sunscreens. They're not supplementing themselves in the winter months with vitamin D, and they get low vitamin D levels. A study by Hanwell et al. Found that children who had a demyelinating event who had a low vitamin D level were much more likely to progress to have a diagnosis of MS than those who had a normal vitamin D level. So what does this mean for nurses? Well, obviously it means that more nurses and MS nurses and pediatric nurses are now caring for children and adolescents with MS. And we have to consider the needs of this population and really understand things like developmental factors. If you're somebody who usually works with adults, what does the developmental issues with children mean? What about their psychosocial needs? Being aware that there's the parental involvement in care, that you're not just treating the child, you're treating the whole family, particularly the parents' involvement. There's issues with schooling, of course. That's their like their work, their employment. You have to be aware of the resources specific to pediatric MS, and also transition to adult care. Pediatric care is quite different from adult care, and those who've been cared for in pediatric facilities may struggle when they are transitioned to adult care providers. So what about these developmental issues I was talking about? Of course, children are constantly growing and developing. You have to be aware of how those issues impact care. Just the fact that dosing of medication is often based on weight. We tend to prescribe most of our medications based on milligrams per kilogram per day, and most MS medications have not been tested in children to sort of find out what would be an ideal dose. And actually, that's quite common with most drugs. Few drugs have been tried in children to find out an exact dose that works out best for them. So that can be certainly a challenge. Care, as I mentioned, involves both the child and the family, so really incorporating the whole family in your care with these kids. And what we often suggest is if you are an adult MS specialist, it's important to collaborate with pediatric professionals to address any developmental needs, especially when you're less familiar with dealing with those. So what about how do children and teens deal differently with MS opposed to adults? My colleague Lynn McMillan and I completed a qualitative study several years ago asking children about their experiences of living with MS. And we asked what really concerns them the most about MS. What's the worst part of having MS? A lot of them talked about their ongoing symptoms, just like adults would, the unpredictability and uncertainty of the relapses, limitations to activities. They want to be active, do the same things as their peers, and when they can't do that, that can be quite upsetting for them. Having the regular injections of medication, though that wasn't necessarily the primary issue for them. One thing that worried them was being treated differently by others. They really wanted to be treated the same by their peers, by other adults in their lives. They often found that parents were more worried about them, would dote over them too much, and would be asking, everything that seemed to be a little different. They'd be saying, "Oh, are you having an attack?" That kind of thing. So they really wanted to just be treated the same. The other thing they were worried about is the impact of MS on their school performance and attendance. Obviously, I said that school is like work for them, and not being able to participate in school can be quite challenging, whether it's because they're missing school for appointments or because they're having relapses. That was quite distressing for them. So how does one educate and support children? Well, the most important thing is to provide the necessary requested information at an age-appropriate level. If you start simpler, in a more simple approach at the younger years, and it becomes more sophisticated as they get a little older. So older teens, you're going to talk to them more like an adult. And also, it's important to re-educate periodically. If a child's diagnosed when they're 7, most of the education is probably happening with the parents. But as they get older, they need to know more about their disease, and you need to keep re-educating them as they become more mature. And also recognize that they may not want a lot of information. They don't tend to be big information seekers, especially when they're fairly young. It tends to be more the parents. So I often encourage the parents just to capitalize on those opportunities to provide education when their children ask. And we often will include the children in the discussions. They may not seem to be paying much attention, but often they have their selective hearing going, and they'll pick up things that they want to hear. Though one question they often don't ask but they worry about is they worry that they're going to die from MS. And we certainly found that with our study. A lot of kids thought they had a brain tumor, that they were going to die, and they're often quite relieved that this wasn't going to be terminal for them like a tumor might be. So it's important to sort of mention that to them even if they don't ask that question. And the other thing is to encourage them to participate in their regular activities with any adaptations as needed. They really want to live a normal life. They want to do all the same things that they've been doing or be able to do new things. And finding ways to help them do that is really important. The big issue tends to be for some of their symptoms is fatigue and heat sensitivity, so really providing some guidance around that. One of our patients, she was really active in softball, and she would go off to these tournaments in the heat of the summer, and she really enjoyed it, but she was just finding that her heat sensitivity was becoming almost unbearable. So she was able to get one of those ice vests and a cooling vest, and she made it all the difference in the world and really made her be able to cope through every game. The other thing is to recognize that parents are their child's primary means of support. So really supporting the parents actually supports the child, so keep that in mind as well. But as teens, they really do need some private time without their parents during clinic visits. So it may not be through the whole visit, but just pulling them aside for a short period of time, talking about those things that they may not want to talk about in front of their parents, whether it's birth control issues, but even sometimes talking about symptoms. They often don't, this came out in our study, they don't want to worry their parents, and sometimes they won't mention that they're having symptoms because they feel like their parents are going to overreact. So sometimes talking to them privately about those things could be helpful. The other thing is just to refer them to a social worker, a psychologist, or a psychiatrist at a pediatric facility if counseling is needed. So how does one support the parents? Well, I often say that really initially the parents are the most burdened by the diagnosis. and they're more aware of what the ramifications of MS might be. They obviously are very concerned about their children and are really the protectors of them, and so it's important to really support them. So that can be through providing them current, accurate information. It's many ways treating the parent like they had the MS themselves, like if you you were talking to an adult patient with MS, but giving that kind of information because they are making those decisions on behalf of their child. Identify resources that are available. Of course, as MS nurses, you always need to offer them some hope. Encourage them to access their personal sources of support, whether that's family or friends, clergy, whoever really can help them in their personal lives. And if needed, similarly to children, refer them for counseling as needed. Now, when you're educating the parents, as I mentioned, educate them as sort of advocates for the children, but also talk about things like disclosure of the diagnosis to others. Many of our children during our interviews with them for the study were saying that they felt like everybody knew they had MS, that the whole neighborhood knew, that everybody at school knew. So just talking about some of those, the key people that need to know and important to talk dialogue with their kids about who really needs to know that they have MS. And also discuss the possible school issues. Certainly cognitive issues are a huge concern for children. It's a quite common concern with children with MS. And what number of studies have found is that there are increased deficits with increased disease duration. Many children will struggle with school achievement and may require some kind of academic support. So that level of support may really vary. So it's really important to refer them for neuropsychological testing if appropriate. Then they can, especially when they complain about things like memory and concentration issues. A lot of kids will complain about that. So it's particularly important to get them tested so that supports can be put into place so they don't gradually fall farther and farther behind in their school performance. And the other thing is, as far as school is concerned, is really to address fatigue issues. Some children just can't stay awake in school, or they're so exhausted at the end of the day that they'll sleep for 3 hours, they don't get their homework done, they don't get their assignments completed. So addressing fatigue, and also even just for things like if they're so busy trying to keep up with their schoolwork, they're too fatigued to deal with any of their social activities or other physical activities. So really trying to address that. And also address things like absenteeism, if they are having to miss school, working with the school personnel. Sometimes we write letters. We'll talk to various people to make sure that these kids don't get too far behind if they're missing school. And it's also, as I said, very important to communicate with the school personnel. I often will write letters just to whom it may concern, and I'll leave it up to the parents and the kids and teens on whether they share those letters with the school or not. So just sort of a general letter about their MS and some of the limitations they may have or issues they may have. So I'm going to talk a little bit about treatment. Certainly there can be challenges when you're dealing with young children because they may not have the cognitive maturity to understand the rationale for things like injections and some of those long-term benefits. They're very much in the here and now. They're not looking towards the future. And even many of the adolescents may not accept that need for treatment. They're the risk takers. They're less worried about the future, that they don't sort of see the immediate benefits, and so would rather not just carry on with their lives and not have to deal with all of this. And it's also important really to involve the parents in the treatment decisions because they really do need to work together as a family to help cope with all of this. Unfortunately, none of the disease-modifying therapies in children have been systematically studied in children, and I said that's quite common for a lot of drugs. They haven't been trialed in children, and unfortunately, the DMTs are not FDA-approved for treatment of patients under 18 years of age. However, they are commonly used. They're found to be safe in pediatric patients with relapsing-remitting MS, and one does not want to wait for, if you've got a 7-year-old with MS and a quite active disease, you really don't want to wait till they're 18 to start treating them. The importance of treating them early is really imperative and trying to advocate for that to happen. So that's just sort of a quick surface discussion about pediatric MS, but I'm hoping that others have questions for me, share some of their experiences. I think that we can have lots of good discussion right now.
Oh, sure, and we will open it up in 1 second. You know, I listened to your presentation. It was absolutely excellent. And what I hear all through it is how important just educating and re-educating the parents and the patients, the children, is all the way through the whole process.
Absolutely, yes, that you really, you know, things change. I think even with adults with MS, things change, but the needs change as kids mature, even moving from elementary school to a high school, and if they're having more issues with fatigue and there's more demands on their academic performance, that kind of thing, that it's really important for them to be aware of what to expect, how to deal with things, and also that the team members are there to support them through it all.
And how many centers do you have in Canada? MS centers that treat pediatric population?
So there's probably really four. There's ours in Toronto. There's one in Calgary. Also, the Children's Hospital in Ottawa has actually recently developed a clinic. And the Children's Hospital in Montreal has been collaborating with the Montreal Neurological Institute and trying to work together on meeting the needs of the pediatric population. So, but there are many children who are followed by child neurologists and try to consult with their adult colleagues or even sometimes with these other centers.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, excuse me, exactly how many MS centers that we have, pediatric centers in the state?
So in the states, the National MS Society has created or supported the development of 6 centers of excellence, and they are they not only, you know, specifically they have adult MS specialists that collaborate with the pediatric neurology specialists, and they deal with the neuropsychological issues, any kind of psychosocial issues and developmental issues specific to children with MS. They're located in Birmingham, Alabama, Boston, Buffalo, Rochester, Minnesota, San Francisco, and Stony Brook, New York. In Stony Brook, New York, they were one of the first centers in the United States, but I know there are several other pediatric neurology centers that do have MS patients that they follow and have their own clinics, but do not necessarily have that specific support from the National MS Society. So if children are in an area where there is no child neurologist or adult MS specialist that can cope with a pediatric MS patient, then the National MS Society will support them in getting to one of these 6 centers throughout the United States.
Okay, great. Thank you. I think now we're ready. Let's open up the queue for any questions that we have in our audience. Manny, is there anybody in queue yet?